You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, after a few weeks away and offline in Mompox. And this is episode 407 of the Columbia Calling podcast. That's right. We put out 50 episodes last year, had a great number of people, some repeat guests on the show. And we will hopefully put out another 50 and, of course, newscasts with Emily Hart. This intro today will be very short because we've got a long podcast for you this week, the start of the year. They will go back to the ordinary size after this one, from 408 onwards. But Emily Hart and I, and she's in London and I'm here in Bogota, have taken questions from you guys. So we sent out a call for questions from our listeners, and we received a good number, and actually we are able to go into these questions and answer them in depth. Some not so much in depth, others in depth, and it's a really great show. We're able to address, you know, journalism, ethics, the elections, Omicron, the Colombian politics, of course, being a white immigrant in Colombia, and so on. So it's a really, really great show for you. So we're going to go over to the newscast with Emily Hart, and then of course we'll be back with our conversation talking about that. Those of you who are Patreon subscribers and therefore and also on Ko-fi, that's ko-fi.com, Columbia Calling, thank you again. On Patreon, we've increased the minimum for those who are new signups, who sign up from today onwards. It'll be $5 a month just for the newscast. Of course, I mean, you know, Emily works incredibly hard for this, and this money goes to her, it's her payment. So it's just $5 a month, less than a Starbucks a month if you want to sign up for the newscast from Emily Hart. We'll be putting some of this stuff out on our members-only Facebook page. Emily's in charge of that, and of course, we'll be posting here and there about everything else. Thank you, everyone. A happy new year to everyone. And don't go away. This is a great show in which we can explore many facets of life and what's going on in Colombia for 2022. Thank you again. Don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories for the week of January 10th, 2022. Guerrilla group the ELN, the National Liberation Army, are in the spotlight this week, in the headlines for violence in two places: the killing of 27 people in Arauca on the Venezuelan border, and an attack on police in the city of Cali. The group began as a leftist insurgency in the 1960s and are now an armed group with around 2,500 members split across 8 fronts and present in various parts of Colombia. The deaths in Arauca, which have taken place since the beginning of the year, were initially reported as relating to armed confrontations between the ELN and a dissident FARC group. This week, however, the Attorney General reported that the victims were shot at close range, in the form of hired killings or executions. President Iván Duque's government has responded by sending military battalions with 625 men. Meanwhile, protests have broken out in the area, demanding an end to human rights abuses, demanding peace, and demanding state presence beyond simply the military. The border area has been the epicentre of violence for decades, a convergence of illegal armed groups, Colombian and Venezuelan government interests, and of permanent state neglect. The departmental capital of Arauca has the highest unemployment rate in the country. It is almost 3 times higher than the national average. Additionally, on Friday night, the ELN perpetrated an explosives attack on a vehicle carrying members of Colombia's anti-riot police force, the ESMAD. The attack injured 13 and killed none in the city of Cali, department of Valle de Cauca. Meanwhile, the prosecution of those responsible for the assassination of the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, continues. Mario Palacios, a former Colombian military officer, has been charged by US authorities with conspiracy to commit murder or kidnapping. These are the first charges to be brought around the assassination, though Haiti has arrested dozens of people following the July murder, including 19 Colombian ex-military personnel. Three further Colombian men were killed by police at the time. According to the New York Times, Moïse was killed for trying to send a list of people involved in drug trafficking to the US. Already this year, there have been four massacres in Colombia, according to think tank Indepaz. The latest was this weekend in Villanueva, Nariño, in which three men between the ages of 19 and 22 were killed in a park where men arrived and began shooting. Four more were injured in the incident. And coronavirus cases are rising dramatically in Colombia amid the arrival of the Omicron variant, with around 30,000 new cases yesterday, up from a daily average of 8,000 this time last week. Though new lockdowns are not on the cards, business and particularly airlines have been affected due to staff shortages. This week, around 40 flights per day are being cancelled, representing around 4% of the country's total operations. However, more than three quarters of Colombians have now had one dose of vaccine and more than half are fully vaccinated. 7% have also had booster jabs. Those were your top stories for the week. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is segment three of episode 407, the first episode of 2022. And it's me and Emily today. Emily in London. Emily Hart, you know her so well, too well. And we're going to chat. We're going to chat and answer your questions later. There have been a lot of questions. Emily, how's London? How are you?
I'm good. London is, the capital of a little place we like to call Plague Island. We're very, very much in the grips of Omicron, but that's to be expected. And I feel like I'll have some ahead of time insights when I get back to Colombia when the same thing is happening there.
So you'll be
all
back.
As well. Yeah.
You'll be back by the end of the month.
Yes, I will be back this month. Okay. I've been back visiting family, a surprise to nobody that I am English. So that's where I come back for Christmas when possible, and I hadn't been back in a couple of years because of COVID. So it has been lovely. Exactly. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
How was yours?
It was great, actually. I mean, our actual celebrations were low-key and family, which was nice. I like it, but it's manageable. I am married into an immense Colombian family, so I think for my behalf and for my wife as well, we managed to get the actual core of the family together rather than everyone, because we could easily have. And the grandmother, who turned 96 in Mompox on the 30th of December, she held a lunch for 30 and 47 people turned up. So there you go.
Wow. It's sort of the opposite in England. You try and have a lunch with three people and two will have COVID at the moment. Those are your stats, I'm afraid.
So you're going to leave Plague Island to come to Omicron Central.
That is the idea. Yeah. I'd say it's intentional, journalistic and out of love, but it's just another horrible COVID related accent.
But since we have Omicron here, you are not patient one.
I certainly will not be. And I am fully vaccinated, of course. And we'll be doing all my PCRs, etc. to get back. But the cases are rising. Those graphs are looking pretty scary.
It's looking scary, but every death is an absolute tragedy, but the fatality rate is low.
Absolutely. It is.
And this is something we will address in a question. Thank you, Harry.
I was looking at the beginning of 2021 as a sort of point of comparison, and that was just as the second wave was hitting. It does feel a little groundhoggy, but But we do know more, and we are all vaccinated now, those of us who are lucky enough. So, you know, there are positive things about the latest round in this endless boxing match.
But we do clutch at this, and we do more than clutch at it because it's been so long. But I will take two amazing things. First of all, this Christmas New Year season for the hotels in Mompos has been better than any other Christmas New Year season we've ever had. Dating back to 2008, we have never had, and I think there obviously people are desperate to travel. And of course, with the peso to the pound, was it 5,500 almost to the pound, 5,400, and to the dollar, your average Colombian cannot go overseas. And so they're getting in their cars, they're getting on the flights and going around the country. And we are still full to this day.
I think people are ready. They're ready to live again.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, if they weren't going to lock down in the UK, I think Colombia will very definitely not be locking down. I would be very, very surprised. And I am very regularly very surprised in Colombia. That is part of what I love about living in Colombia, is that there is never a shortage of things one didn't think could or would happen.
This is it. I am surprised. And then at the same time, I'm jaded because I'm like, oh yeah, of course it did.
I'm a relative newcomer. So maybe my jaded years yet.
Your spring chicken and stuff. There we are. So I don't know. What are we? I mean, this. I wanted to also share is very, very well, kind of a very personal story here. That someone I hadn't seen in 26 years since I'd been at high school in the U.S. in New Jersey in 1996. Visited us in Mompos. She got in touch. I had no idea who she was because she used her married name. She got in touch. It turns out that she was adopted from Colombia at 2 months. And so therefore in her mid-40s, now her children are asking after her, you know, her roots. So she came down to explore Colombia. And I think what is most exciting about it is, you know, you can talk openly with her. I said, Karen, I mean, you're indigenous. You are not Cundiboya Sensei. You are not one of these. And we were able to sort of, she was one of those adopted babies during the scandal of sort of legalized child trafficking, let's say, you know, the adoption business. And she showed me her documentation, and it's done through all those businesses that I have investigated from way back in the 80s that were responsible for this, just signing off the Catholic Church, in a lot of cases, not all, was involved, telling poor mothers either that their child had died in childbirth or that the mother, you're too poor, you've got too many children, it's better to give this child up. But we are managing to trace back that she's possibly of the Nasa people around Putumayo Cauca area. But that's as far as we can get. I mean, amazing though, and wonderful after 26 years to have 3 days chatting and going through this. It was really quite touching that someone would make such an effort.
Yeah. But also that you can reveal so much of someone's story.
I've done a lot of investigating, sort of superficial investigating for people who have been adopted from Colombia. Normally they're like Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, and places, you know, sort of, let's say, Christian families adopting children from tragic circumstances in Colombia. And they've asked me to look at the documentation and give them. So I've got a little bit of knowledge of how to read between the lines in some of them. And it was just being able to actually help someone who I knew and now know again, because 26 years is a long time. How old are you? Hang on, you're like 26.
That's not my whole life. I am a dignified amount into my 30s. Okay. I won't say how many years. It's not very many.
I was just like, looking at you, I was like, hang on a second. It's like before you were born.
not quite before I was born. I wouldn't have been very tall. Let's just say that.
Okay, fair enough. You could. Well, that's all right. Anyway, that was my personal story for this. And, you know, 26-year absence. And we actually got on really well back in the day at high school in the US. And it was so nice to reconnect and so on. But that said, so now we're into, I had to sort of explain a little bit about Columbia because she lives in Colorado. And of course, the news agenda in Colorado isn't great on Columbia. interesting though, she works as an advisor for the fiscal general. Is that what you call them? Fiscal general of like the governor general of Colorado. And so her first job was Omicron, and her second job has been the Colorado fires. So there you go. And top of that, trying to explain what has been going on in Colombia for the last 40 years in 3 days was something. But
I'm not a concise enough answer possible to that question.
And so literally, I mean, sort of leads us in is like 2022. It's a big year. It's a big year for Colombia. Every year is a big year, but this is maybe bigger.
Yeah, I feel I looked back at all of the transcripts from the news report from the entirety of the last year. And I have to say there was very little in there that was brand new. There's so many huge, huge threads that have been running in continuity for so, so long. And I do feel like 22 is the year when we might have some actual new. The scale of the paro, of the national strike last year was, genuinely impressive and extraordinary. But, the paro nacional has been something that's been around for a very long time.
The causes of which, are inherent in society.
Right, absolutely. And the peace process ongoing, all of those HEP cases that came out ongoing, even COVID-19 was sort of old news by last year. Climate, particularly the abortion debate, political violence, these issues morph and change, but there was a lot of just continuity in 2021. Aside from, I think the one thing that I could say I felt genuinely sort of was new was the assassination of the Haitian president and the inclusion of Colombians. But you scratch the surface and the use of Colombian mercenaries in international conflict, politics and assassination, not new.
It's not new.
Yeah,
The Haitian thing, maybe it's new for a different generation, isn't it? Because it just brought it close, especially for those of us here. It's like to wake up and then see 17 Colombian mercenaries there. And
26. It was a team.
And then it was so easy to trace as well. I mean, that was the thing. I think they were, set up as well. I know that it was sent over there, but they were going to be easy fall guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this word, the mastermind behind the crime, I sort of hate it. It sounds like a terrible crime novel, but, the intellectual author of that crime, which again is a horrible phrase. I haven't found one I like yet. Is still unknown. Meanwhile, a Colombian has been charged with the crime. I think you're absolutely right. It's an easy
It's an easy out. And hang on, intellectual author. They use that here, don't they? A lot in Colombia.
Yes.
Los autores intelectuales de la bomba. And you're like, the intellectual author.
So in law, you have the material author who carry out the crime, and then the intellectual author who has essentially commissioned the crime indirectly through another actor.
So it's legalese.
I'm afraid I did study law after I studied literature. So I have some things that slip in and out of the way that I speak that are either incomprehensible or very dull. But that distinction I do find, particularly in the region that we work in, very useful. Because lots of crimes are, commissioned.
Commissioned.
And then carried out by mercenaries.
Another way of putting it, isn't it? The commission.
I know, I make it sound like it's a television series or something.
But I don't know. So maybe we will. Maybe we'll have actual news, and maybe we'll have let's say some different things to report on. Because I think, many years ago, I worked for a wire service, and I worked out over the couple of years that I actually ended up regurgitating many of the same articles, just changing the dates. It could have been forest fires, and it could have been social leaders being killed, soldiers being bombed, and so on. It was not, not too much of difference came through. It would be nice to find something that we could get our teeth into as journalists that would be something, but maybe pointing in a positive way, and also, as you say, different to some the age old sort of heart of darkness type reporting that we end up doing.
It's not same old, and it is, you know, particularly with COVID, that was a really interesting intersection of of new and old in lots of areas. But a lot of these stories are continuations. I have some hope that an election year might bring some innovation into the politics. And certainly, you know, as a features journalist, I do lots of, you know, finding things that are actually new, but so many of them are on quite a small scale. They're not, you know, they're not news in the sense of the news that I report for this podcast. It's smaller stories, quirkier stories, which are awesome, but, you know, the peace process rumbles on. There's still no international coverage of this country that doesn't begin with, in spite of the peace process 5 years ago. You know, it's
so long a byword for cocaine and kidnapping. And
I mean, as long as it's not the cocaine hippos, if that story could die in 2022, my wish would be
I just have to say that in Jordan Salama's book, Every Day the River Changes, he says that the hippos have got as far as Magangay, which is the next big town over from Mompos.
So I was there. Yeah, I loved it. I didn't see them, I'll be honest.
No, I think they're quite solitary in that area.
I'd have gotten the slightest glimpse, I'm sure. I would have sold out immediately and sold a piece to Vice, but I didn't. Vice. I can still keep this moral high ground on the hippos.
They will all buy it. All of them will buy it because it's kind of clickbait, isn't it? It's a clickbait thing. It's that curious thing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, lots of stories about Colombia are not sexy, maybe because they're not new, because they're updates on old. I mean, one does hope the abortion thing will just go through this year and we can have a good news story at least for some.
I would hazard a guess that if the front runner at the moment, Gustavo Petro, is still a while before the elections, a few months.
It's long enough.
Yeah, a few months. If he wins, he will move towards more progressive policies, trying to push them through. Although, I think that the establishment will probably not allow him to govern as he does, and it will be like a kind of AMLO situation in Mexico, where he just sort of governs bitterly. That's if he wins.
Yeah, I do. You know, Petro being the old left, I think you're getting this split in Latin America in the last few years of elections. Things are moving left, but they're moving left in two ways. Got your, like, your crusty left and your young left.
So Petro's the crusty left.
I would say the idea of, like, an exciting oppositional left to me looks more like Boric.
M. Chile.
Right. You know, youngest president they've ever, I mean, to be fair, Duque is the youngest president that Colombia's ever had too, and that's not, you know, turned out for much, but Boric is the youngest. He's 35. He was a student leader. There's a kind of exciting hands-on left going rather than a sort of crusty discursive left, which in AMLO's case doesn't really like women and isn't that progressive and has, you know, very authoritarian tendencies towards the press. And, you know, these two lefts are not, to me, the same left. And you know, Lula's what, 76? And he's taken the space of a younger leftist candidate who was rising. I think, you know, I find it very difficult to get excited about old political men being the face of opposition or change, you know. Maybe that's me and a sort of boring feminist cynicism, but I'm afraid that, you know, I can't look at Petro's face and think that's the future.
He's not inspirational on that level, Would you say he's an establishment figure now after so long in politics?
I mean, the thing with, you know, with Colombian politics is that he would be the first sort of real lefty in institutional politics. You know, there is no old left in the same way that there is in Mexico. The comparison doesn't quite track.
No.
It would be something genuinely new, but he's still an insider. He's still, you know, an old dude. He's been at it a while. I don't know. I struggle to believe that therein lies the solution myself.
Oh, no, I don't believe that he's a solution on any level. I don't see any of them. We've got the Centro Democrático guy is Oscar Iván Zuluaga, who is himself a graduate of Masters in Business from Exeter University in the UK. My alma mater, there you go.
Yeah, I mean...
He doesn't get invited to alumni meetings here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be too partisan, but aren't we done with the Centro Democrático?
I genuinely think they're in serious decline. All right, so you're looking at the polls.
Yeah, and the approval ratings for Uribe are very, very low.
27 or something, or 19?
Lower than they have been in a very long time. You know, one could speculate for hours about why that is, but I think crucially, at least in terms of the electorate, that star is falling a bit. You know, Duque again, terrible approval rating. His disapproval rating fell by like a point this week, but his approval rating is still like astonishingly low. whereas, you know, Petro is doing pretty well.
Yeah.
But the rebase power is not necessarily electoral, should we say.
Yeah, don't underestimate the man in his Crocs.
Yes, never underestimate the man who can so brazenly and with such confidence. I think he's to be feared.
I think so too.
That happens to be where I'm at.
I hate to say it. It's sort of like, I'm just going to watch this election and do some political analysis, hopefully for some places here and there and some articles. But as a citizen, not a Colombian, but as a resident in Colombia, I'm just a little bit wary.
Absolutely. And I, you know, as a Brit, as a fellow Brit, we have learned, if we've learned anything as a nation in the last 5 years, which I do not argue that we have by any means, the polls cannot be trusted.
No.
They were so, so wrong on the last election. They were so wrong about Brexit.
Mm.
I don't claim to have much knowledge of how these things work in terms of political polling, but, you know, a pinch of salt, a salt flat, all of it, just throw it on there, because I, you know, and particularly in Colombia, there is 4 months, which is a long time.
It's a really long time. And we know that the dead vote and some people and so on, I don't know. And towns and people sell their votes. And it's an incredibly profitable business to buy votes, to earn the contracts in small towns. And this is where the administrative sort of elections will come in as well, because that's all sort of these local elections will come in and see how, I don't know, from a sort of, I don't want to say grassroots, but from a lower level, which goes about sort of controlling vast swathes of the country.
Absolutely. And then, you know, there are other tools that are not political. Sergio Fajardo's been fighting a lawsuit. Uribe has been trying to remove the mayor of Medellin. There is, you know, there are things that aren't the polls that we have to be watching as well, as well as the political violence, which was up 6 months ago already in anticipation of these elections. There's so much to be looking at in 2022.
It's
on the national stage and then international on top of that. I think it's going to be a really very interesting year.
It's definitely an interesting year. But we always say that. Never dull in Colombia. Definitely. Shall we address some questions? Because we got a few, and I only made the shout out a couple of days ago.
Yeah, we should. I have the ones that I'm aware of.
All right. Well, who do you, because we've got journalism ones, which we can group together, and we've got politics ones, which probably group together and then feed into journalism. And then we've got ones which are a bit different.
Well, we're on politics. All right. Should we start with politics? And
all right. All right. Wiggling. Well, so how about the first? The first question we received is from Eric Taboni, who's in Bogota himself, or traveling around at the moment. He's a long-term immigrant to Colombia from the US. He owns an English language company here, which I believe is for sale. So, you know, if you want it, there you go. But he asked, and he's a supporter of the podcast, he asked, how do you see the political landscape playing out, and how will the international community respond? And I think we'll just follow that one up with, hang on, I'll turn that over, with Emma Louise Jay, who great friend to the podcast and everyone. And she says, what is the forecast for 2022? Or is it too risky for us to say and just report on the present? So I thought they kind of fed into one another, that one.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, you know, there's a sort of... I don't want to say paranoiac, but a sort of anxious response that says if the election goes left, the US steps in, because we've all seen that happen in the last, you know, decade, century in this continent. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think there is still a sort of lunatic McCarthyist anti-commie undercurrent red under the bed thing going on with the US. Not saying there isn't at all. But I think it's focused on Venezuela. And that is very much the focus of the international interest. Yeah. And I was talking to a friend who works for the British military who said, like, yes, the war on drugs is still a thing. Yes, people are interested in Colombia, but they are mostly interested in Colombia, particularly from that institution's point of view, because it is next to Venezuela. And because there is a proxy war between, you know, new communism and the West, which is an expression I hate, but he insists on using it, going on there. So for me, the international response is to anything that happens in Colombia looks like it's intimately bound up with what's going on in Venezuela.
I think you're right. For Biden, let's say, if we're talking about the President Biden and the US, to meddle too much in Colombia and the Americas, let's say south of Mexico, let's say, is a poison chalice anyway, with so many issues that he has at home. I would say it's just you don't come out of this region winning. this is a cemetery for international, let's say, foreign relations, isn't it? I mean, it just you come out at some point being losing at some level. I think Venezuela will always be key, won't it? And because I mean, oil production, we have to say that. Colombia being the US's number one, if not only real ally for so long, means that it does occupy a position in sort of international relations and international cooperation with the US and the donations of all of these military aid and so on. But would they get involved? I doubt it.
I think intervention is completely out of the question as far as I see it. I think which way this election goes I hate predicting things, but my little sort of anxious looking into the future brain suggests that, you know, the further Latin America goes left, the more space there is for collaborations with the Chinese regime. And that's what we're already seeing, is moving away from the US, which are perceived as interventionist and imperialist, and moving towards a government that is, I mean, there aren't words for the human rights abuses of the Chinese regime within their own borders and outside of them. But in terms of military aid, I was looking at the figures. There's a, who's this report by the Global Americans, which again, like pinch of salt, but the amount of Chinese investment tracks almost exactly down political lines. The scale of it in countries that move left, or, you know, if you include Venezuela, is absolutely massive. And in the last few years, the number of countries in this region that have broken off diplomatic relations with Taiwan in favor of Beijing is an indicator. So for me, that's another big player in this region.
It was Guatemala that just did it. The most recent one, wasn't it? Guatemala, one of the central.
I think it was. It's one of those. What's it? I would have to look that up. Listeners, check your facts. It's an indicator because, you know, that will be quietly a condition of investment and you know, collaboration, let's call it.
Just get an idea out there and I'll be lambasted by some people, is that, and let me just clarify right from the start, I am not a petrista, but should Petro get in a left-wing government, and having a left-wing government doesn't mean no investment. It's a stability thing as well, isn't it? I mean, if we take the most extreme version of this would be Vietnam. Yeah, and they've built an investment. I'm not saying it's a perfect model. I'm defending myself on every outlet here, but I just want to say
a lot of preemptive defense going on.
Yeah, a lot of, because I know what's happening. I know what people are, you know, sort of twisting or turning this off. But it doesn't mean you can't invest. It just means you need to work out who's in power and how best to deal with it. You know, isn't that? Do we not think that way?
I think you can think that way. There's still, you know, a lot of. You know, and Colombia's arguably not had an easy time of it. The form of the left that has been present in Colombia, yeah. To put it mildly. And I can see, you know, particularly given who's to the east, how there might be a regional and international fear of what the left looks like in this region. You know, there are lots of ways of being, you know, quite easily able to understand the fears that people are feeling. But I think you're right. And one hopes that, I'm about to say something even I don't believe, am I? One hopes that the democratic structures of Colombia are strong enough to withstand a leftist government in a way that looks appealing to the outside world.
I think that's very well put.
Strong enough that the business landscape is stable enough that, you know, a slight change in political ideology across the spectrum of Congress and presidency does not mean Venezuela.
I think we need the democratic institutions need to be strong enough to, and also to convince Colombians that this is not going to be the case as well. As I think there's two levels, isn't there? And that would lead into our journalism questions a little bit, because we are seeing, and Harry Cross,
yes,
made a nice reference to, he said, back in the 1960s, El Tiempo was a paragon of newspaper reporting, analysis, and opinion. El Tiempo looks like Fox News to me these days, strongly slanted against, and in open quotations, terroristas and protesters, sensational murders, crimes, car accidents, etc., and no dealing with the real issues of the day like corruption, inequality, and poverty. A free press, media, is central to democracies. Has the conservative political class and their wealthy backers captured the press and media? I think you've covered this in the past, but it seems certain that inequality and poverty and the impacts of COVID will be key drivers in the run-up to the elections in 5 months. So he kind of covers it all there, but very important points.
It is. And, you know, the free media, in the run-up to an election period is absolutely crucial. The work I do on the side of being a journalist, I do a report on global freedom of expression every year, which is based on a big data set. And we measure 30 variables, and we look at the way that free speech and democracy intersect. And what you see across so many countries, this is an undeniable pattern in this data over the last 100 years, media freedoms go first. Media freedoms will drop, and then the democratic institutions will come under attack, and the democratic score will fall as a whole. This data is by an institute called VDEM. If you're a data nerd, as I have become by doing this project, please check out their stuff. It's super interesting. And this is, you know, across regions, across countries, across types of regime and government, this is the pattern. And if your media goes, if the strength of your media institutions are eroded, or, you know, in some countries it happens more rapidly than the word erode would be able to capture, your elections are in serious trouble. I think for me, there is something specific and threatening that's going on. And it is, you know, and I'll come to that in a second, but I think we have to pull out a little bit. And this, you know, this work I do, I sort of need to take this approach to feel sane some of the time. But the internet is a huge, huge technological advance that has changed many, many things. And we are still adapting. We are in, as a global society, a phase of adaptation. One of the things that it has radically changed is the profit model for media. And those effects have been almost universally fucking terrible. And I think we can all acknowledge that. Needing to click on things, sensationalist content being more profitable and therefore making more money, this does good to no society. But I am not hopeless. I think we're in an adaptation phase, and lots of media is being captured by this clickbaity, tabloidy, and it often does lean right model, where, you know, the thing you want to click on is the most horrible thing. It's a car wreck. It's a video of a car wreck. It's that horrible video that's all over the place of a big rock falling on a boat in Brazil and killing seven tourists. I mean, why is that everywhere? It's a snuff film. And it's part of this complete explosion of the way that media made money and people's expectation that they're going to get content for free. So I think, yes, it has been easy for the right to capture. And I agree, El Tiempo's decline is a tragedy. I mean, what happened to Semana, Richard, we were talking about it before we started recording. You know, it's dire. It is really, really bad. And it does affect public opinion. I do think, you know, those journalists, and I appreciate that, you know, we're journalists, we've got the time and inclination to hunt these people out. But the journalists who exodused, if such a thing was a verb, Semana, they still exist. They're around and they're doing amazing work. The media institutions are eroded, but we can follow Maria Jimena Duzan. And I think we had a question about who our favorite journalists
that
are.
That was from Jeffrey Ratcliffe.
Right, and I think this feeds in quite nicely, that it puts the work on the citizen, on the reader, to inform yourself in a slightly exhausting way, where you can't just go to this great magazine you used to read. You have to hunt down these amazing journalists you love. I mean, don't like the expression, but somewhat of a basic bitch, I would imagine, in that I love Maria Jimena Duzan, I love Daniel Coronel, I read Los Danieles, you know, Matarife, but you have to hunt, right? I mean, Richard, what are you reading?
Well, I've tried to read the internet, but
I like not a good idea.
Daniel Coronel, of course, Maria Jimena Duzan, almost anything. In fact, I actually know her reasonably well. It's always nice to talk to her. And incredibly informed and incredibly open. But it's Semana. I keep them on my Twitter feed to see how they are moving. And it's like a journalistic or an editorial experiment, but I will not open the articles because it's designed. It's just designed to, I mean, it's like, it's almost a honey trap of journalism. It's clickbait.
I agree. I mean, but for those of you who watch Succession, I think though what is happening is a creeping to the right, to sensationalist tabloids, garbage of lots of our media, the bigger force is just mindless capitalism in the digital age. It's Logan Roy. You know, he's not really a fascist. Some might be. He's not really one, but it suits his business model. He'll make more money selling it. These are the channels. These are the online models that are profitable. And we will evolve beyond that, I hope, at some point.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine. I do love that show, firstly. And quite right that it won a Golden Globe. Yesterday? Day before? But I do share a sense of bleakness with Harry about the Colombian press. And it is really annoying that we now have to hunt these fragments of great media through the landscape. I read a lot of Colombian magazines. I read Pacifista, I read Vorágine, Liga Contra Silencio is great when they publish. And I think that touches on this question of who our favorite journalists are. I think a lot of the best journalism and the most important journalism are people we can't name. So La Liga publishes under only that name because that's the safest thing for them to do. Lots of amazing local journalism by people who you've never heard of, who are the most at risk. You know, those are the best journalism, the best journalists in my view. I have to say, I do still read Semana because I'm very, not for fun, I assure you. I'm very keen when I put together the news briefing to read the full spectrum. It would be very easy for me to just read La Silla Vacía and El Espectador and sort of like, you know, have some news. But I read El Tiempo and I read Semana because as a journalist, and I think as a citizen, and I know this is annoying and no one likes me saying it, but you've just got to read everything. That is your responsibility now. We're living through this shitty, weird adolescence of the internet. It's angry, it's right wing, it hates everything. And it's your job to read as widely as you can because that's the only way you're going to know what's going on. However, Emma sent in a really interesting question that I think...
how do journalists protect their mental health?
Which I think feeds into this. While I say read everything, also occasionally read nothing. You know? do you know what I'm saying? I think the like constant plugged in-ness, or like you say, trying to read the internet will make you mad.
Yeah, I kind of switched off for the last couple of weeks.
To be fair, so did most journalists in Colombia, from what I've seen of those papers. So TV news in Colombia makes me very sad.
I won't watch sort of the news, and it is because the last time, and it was over years ago now, and it was always car crashes, and then I would get calls like from my my father-in-law who would say, "Oh, you know, have you seen this news about a poor baby that drowned in a pool in Barranquilla?" And be like, "No, I haven't seen it. So just be careful, okay?"
I mean, but I'm not a baby in a pool. Also, there's a sense that like all apocalypses and all disasters are our disasters. My mum, who I love very much, just regularly wanders into a room with Twitter open, announces the death of a famous person, and then leaves again. It's just like, it is this like sense that we all need to know, we all need to be plugged in. And you know, some of the topics that Emma covers are incredibly heavy, and to be 24/7 as you well could be with the existence of the cesspit that is Twitter, you could spend your whole life connected to violent images and violent facts, and it, you know, protecting your mental health, I think, is not covering conflict sometimes. And I don't mean give it up as a job. I just mean protect your free time. Yeah, and really finding ways to totally disconnect, you know.
But my friend Malcolm Linton, who's a conflict photographer,
and has been
he stepped back from conflict photography after a while because he felt not only that too much was going on and he was too immersed in these things and needed to get out, and trained up as a nurse to help people. Right now, actually, he's gone back to nursing right now.
Fantastic profession. I think the thing, you know, what I would bring from my experience in humanitarian situations, because I worked in the Calais refugee camp when it had, you know, 11,000 people living in it during the winter. It was a very, very bleak situation. And lots of us felt totally unable to disconnect from this like horrible situation. And while that sounds like a we're such good people thing, I think you have to always have in mind that you are not irreplaceable. if the work that you do affects you in a very negative way, and you feel unable to sustain your well-being while doing it, you have to either share that work or take a step back, train someone up and put them in so that you can manage it in a way that's sustainable. And I think lots of humanitarian workers make this mistake as well, is not feeling able to take a week off. But I believe very few people in the whole of history have been so unique that they can't take a week off work and have someone step in for them or have someone help them out. I simply don't believe in human uniqueness to that degree. And it's a slight sort of ego release to say, like, it is just me doing this work, but I could have someone help me, but someone else could do it for a month, or maybe someone else can take this article.
I covered this a little bit with an Italian humanitarian worker, Sabrina Prioli, who'd spent a long time in Colombia and then was in, I want to say, South Sudan. And they overran the rebels, took over their UN compound. She was rich soldiers. And she has set up a foundation for, what do you call it? For relief, for aid for humanitarian workers themselves.
Yeah, and journalists and researchers who work on conflict, you know, secondary trauma is a genuine psychological phenomenon. And again, you know, constantly bashing on about media policy, but if you're a freelancer and not a staff member, you have absolutely no support from anybody. And sometimes you get a bit, you know, beautiful mind. You're not even sure what exists and what's real anymore, let alone someone checking in on your mental health. I mean, you can feel very unsupported in that. And I think academia, you know, has a very similar issue in lots of ways.
So let's get into Martin Kopp's question, because it's kind of a lot of, I think, what he says will actually feed back to your issue on the, let's say, the profit model. Because he says, you know, he asks, why today 90% of journalism is only political manipulation and it's lost its basics like ethics, objectivity, and quality? Most is only copy and paste without checking if it is real, or like most of the time, fake news. Now, I want to get into that quite quickly and just say, I can't take the term fake news. I can say, if you want it as propaganda, it's one thing. And the other thing is, it's a very, I hate, again, Trumpist way of just, condemning universally in one fell swoop, a whole segment of the media, because it's an uncomplimentary subject or something that paints someone, something, some episode in a negative light that you don't like. It doesn't make it fake news. So I want to get rid of that phrase. That's my bugbear for 2022.
I would love to see that phrase go, because it is something that Trump popularized. And for me, I think there are two really interesting things that come out of this question, which for me are the two things that lie at the heart of this problem. And one is that aforementioned model, I would rather call it viral online disinformation. But then, you know, I work with NGOs and academics, and that kind of language doesn't turn them off, whereas normal people, it does. But that's where the real problem is where these clickbait profit models and also, you know, strategic political factions spread intentionally certain types of information to suit certain types of agenda. And when I say information, I mean lies in this context. Things that you know to be untrue that you spread. That is the dangerous element of fake news. And, you know, there have been people in Iran dying of drinking bleach because they were told by someone online or in a WhatsApp group that was a cure for COVID. You know, there are genuine, you know, and in a pandemic, life or death style dangers that come with viral online disinformation with no accountability. However, on the other side of this coin is exactly what you're talking about. It's this authoritarian, anyone that disagrees with me is lying thing that relates to a deep political polarization that is unable to see outside of its own perspective. Anything that disagrees with it is a lie, which is a fundamental misunderstanding of what truth and lies are, as opposed to opinions and other opinions. You know, there's a redefinition of what truth and lies are coming out of these authoritarian leaders. And we've had, during the pandemic, minimum 17 new pieces of legislation by governments with criminal penalties for those who spread fake news. And these laws are already, in countries across this region and in others, being used to jail journalists. So these are our two dangers, is that fake news is both a real thing and a very useful political entity for manipulation. And I don't think that the answer is laws criminalizing people who spread fake news. A lot of people are either not aware that it's not true what they're spreading, making a real good faith attempt at telling the truth and just not quite managing to. You know, these things do happen too, and you have a right, you do have a right to be wrong. That's allowed. Obviously, the intentional spreading of misinformation about political candidates is a serious problem, and we might well see what effects that has in Colombia this year. I mean, Brazilian elections also this year. That's a country where misinformation, intentional misinformation via WhatsApp groups, i.e. where you can't track the information that's going out, has been a massive problem. Big investigations by the Supreme Court into Bolsonaro's political wings, very intentional creation of that content. We will see. I mean, I spoke to Columbia Check last month for a feature I was writing, who are Columbia's fact-checking group. So they try and track viral disinformation. And they have an entire new team and coalition set up ready for the elections. They are braced because they know what's coming. And they were born at the time of the referendum on the peace deal, because this was certainly an issue then and the need was observed. And this, you know, they're a fantastic group. Check them out online if you're interested, because they will try and monitor what is the most viral lie of that week and fact check it and correct it. The problem, as I'm sure Martin has identified also, is that you can do a fact check and you correct the check. Is your fact check going to get as many clicks as the original lie? You know, no. it's an incredibly complex issue that I've given a very long answer to the question to without really being able to synthesize, I'm afraid.
Pernicious impact of partisanship.
You need a pop filter for a sentence like that.
Well, I think, I mean, we've got a few more questions and then we'll bring this to a close. I think the next one that we need to address is from Angie Devon in Florida.
Yes.
And it just says, can you reflect on what it's like to be sharing the Colombian experience as a white man? What complications does this present? Have you encountered pushback from Colombians or others about your perspectives or experiences? The answer to the second part of that is yes. And to the first part, certainly, as a white man, on the whole, we are treated with deference in Colombia, which I would sometimes prefer not to be treated like that. I would prefer to be sort of just treated as if I was someone else. But of course, I'm just not someone else. I'm a white man here, so you're right. I have tried over the almost 16 years to have been... I'm no longer completely impartial. Of course I'm not, because the articles I choose to write just show a subjectivity and an interest in issues that I feel are important, and the ones I wish to sell as well. So therefore, you know, I can't come from this objectively at all. In terms of business and other things, I have had pushback. I have had quite a lot of issues, almost campaigns in our contra, legal, illegal, clandestine, whatever you want. I tend in the small town, Mompos, where I you know run my businesses and so on. I tend not to be political at all, and just stay out of it. There is a group of people trying to get me to run for mayor, which I have declined and declined and declined. I can't anyway, because I'm not a Colombian citizen. So let's start with that.
It's a good excuse to avoid the question, I think.
It's flattering, but get involved in local politics would also be becoming a cog in the political corruption and political, of the, what was the words that Harry used? The, hang on, he got it in here. Just a second. The conservative political class. It would be the political class and their wealthy backers who control all of the contracts in these regions, where 30% of every contract goes to them. So that's why over 30% of every construction contract never gets finished.
Oh, yeah, I can't say that's a statistic that surprises me, to be honest.
I don't know if I've answered it. I think I might have skirted around it a bit. Do you have anything to say as a white woman?
Yeah, I think as a... My response to this is best told through a sort of violent internal reaction I had to. I was talking to a journalist friend who was frustrated with something a Colombian had said to her. And she said, it's so annoying because I know more about Colombia than that person does. And I just had this like violent internal response, like you could read every newspaper in Colombia for 100 years. And you do not know more about Colombia than any Colombian person who's been alive for 3 days. You know, unless you are Colombian, you cannot lay claim to the Colombian experience. You are an outsider. And I think as a person writing on Colombia and sometimes forming international opinion on Colombia, you have to be acutely self-aware that you are an outsider and that's your role. And you do not have superior knowledge. And the best you can ever do is listen. And not write a whole article, leave a space for a quote, and go to a Colombian to get a quote to fill part three. You go to your sources and you listen to them and you allow them to shape your perspective. And that's how you are able to report in what I think is sort of with self-awareness. And, you know, it's also, you know, there are very few non-Colombian journalists in Colombia. It's a horrible double negative. Who are non-white? Do you know what I mean? I don't know any English Latino or American Latino journalists working in Medellin. So this whiteness that we all carry, I think, is a good reminder. You know, take a look in the mirror. Like, I'm not fooling anyone. No one thinks I'm Colombian, and that's in some ways good, because I'm not going to forget either. And I love the place and I feel deeply connected to it and I'm fascinated to it. But you won't ever catch me saying that I know more than a Colombian child about the country. You just don't.
That's a good answer there. We're going to jump topics. Because we do. Sean St. Marie has sent in a question about visas. Colombia proposing to make it harder to get a visa. I currently have a migrant rentista visa, but they are proposing getting rid of that type of a visa and making it just a visitor visa without the possibility of permanent residency after 5 years. They are also proposing getting rid of the investor visa. Is Colombia getting sick of foreigners, or is it some other political issue? I fear we would speculate, as you say.
Yes, I've had all kinds of problems with visas, the large majority of which are entirely a result of my own complete incompetence. So I don't feel qualified to even comment one word on that, if I'm honest, Richard. I think I'll hand it over to you.
I don't think Colombia's getting sick of foreigners, and I don't think it's really a great political issue. I just think every, it's kind of cyclical every a few years, or let's say, these things do change a bit. And obviously a government will look for the form in which it can make, you know, more income. So if it means changing some visas and creating different loopholes and making their websites even more complicated, then they'll do so. I couldn't possibly give you a straight answer to that, Sean, and I apologize for it. Harry has his second question, and it's on COVID, and I think we can answer that quickly too. I've noticed a huge spikes in COVID infections in the past week. You reported 2,000 daily cases just a week or two back. Now I see it's 38,000 yesterday. Any updates on the Omicron spread, impacts, and government responses would be welcomed.
The update is that it is spreading. I mean, that would be my major update on the spread. Yes.
My wife, an epidemiologist, looked into this for me, so I'm going to defer to her, unless you have something to add.
Go ahead.
They've decreased you no longer have to do a 14-day isolation in Colombia. It's a 7-day one, so you've got that. And you don't have to do the test. If you've got the symptoms, you've got it. That's what we found out today. So just if you have got the symptoms, just treat it as if you've got Omicron. If you are double vaccinated and in contact with a carrier, you don't have to isolate or test. And Omicron, this is actually from a government page, is not considered as severe by the government. And I suppose when they say that, it's severe in terms of fatalities.
Yeah, I mean, that's a truly chaotic vibe. I don't know how else to put it, that list of, not least because asking people to assume they have it without testing in Colombia, where people's employers are not sympathetic and people do not have paid sick leave, people are not going to isolate because they've sneezed and miss work. You know, there's nothing realistic about that guidance as far as I can see. But, you know, we've had testing shortages even here in the UK in the month that I've been back. And they love testing here. Like, I'm staying with my parents because I'm visiting my family, and they don't bring me a cup of tea in the morning. They bring me a lateral flow test on a tray. And I only wish that was a joke. That's a real life thing that I'm experiencing. It's, you know, still thoughtful in its way, but, you know, the testing, it's a real culture here. And I was, you know, surprised and impressed by it. But it begs the question, are the enormous numbers of cases being reported in the UK in some way related to the enormous amount of testing going on in the UK? And, you know, certainly with Omicron, it looks a lot like a cold, according to the new NHS updates on it. So it's hard to know, but I would say I don't see lockdowns. I think, you know, no expert I've read, no government spokesperson has suggested that any amount of case numbers is going to lead to another lockdown.
And a final question. It's from Matt Smith, who's from the other perspective, from Martin Cobb. And he says, why is Medi in a free range lunatic asylum for gringos? And lots of our listeners are in Medellin, so therefore I'm going to say it's not a free-range lunatic asylum for gringos. And Emily lives in Medellin, so she's better placed.
I do. I'm an inmate, I suppose, in that case. Or a patient. Free-range. Maybe free-range. A patient is there. Yes, I mean, sounds really nice being a free-range lunatic, to be quite honest. Yeah, I mean, there are lots of very colourful characters in Medellin from the international community. Some of them behave in ways one approves of, others don't. And, you know, I think it's a place you can go and not be terribly accountable for your behaviour if you have money or earn in dollars or pounds. I think it liberates people from the social mores of the places they come from and the financial restrictions they may have had in those places. I could do, you know, a very easy long rant about gross white men in Medellin, but I won't, because I, you know, I think there's lots of really great expats and immigrants to Medellin who contribute in, you know, meaningful ways, both economically and socially. But, you know, we all know or are aware of the unpleasant ones.
And it's, you know, I think it's a tiny number, but they're so visible. I think the conversation I had with an interviewee from last year who said, and it, you know, he didn't want to be quoted on this. He says, why is there a gentleman with a younger lady, you know, a much younger, sitting in the Sheraton talking about he can recommend lawyers? I mean, why would that guy, a US guy down here, need a lawyer if he wasn't doing something? You know, he was sickened by it, he said, because he knew what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, one comes across things that make you uncomfortable, and there's, you know, there's active criminality and, you know, sex tourism, child sex tourism, drugs tourism. It's all there. It is. And that, I don't think, is a secret to anyone who spent 10 minutes in Medellin, certainly not in Poblado. On the other hand, there's men who try and explain Bitcoin to me. Both of these types of gringo, not a fave. That's all I'm saying. Not on the same scale of ethical horribleness, but one can take exception where one looks for it. And, you know, certainly there's an American Americanization happening. And if one is not a fan of that, I can see, you know, if you've been in Medellin for a long time, maybe you're seeing changes that you don't necessarily like culturally. You know, I've only been there for a few years, so, you know, I wouldn't like to comment or pretend I'm some kind of old timer, to be honest. But I would also say a certain type of lunacy is natural and maybe nice. You know, there's lots of very interesting nonconformist folks knocking around too.
I'd say we're all lunatics here in Bogota.
Yes, it's interesting that Medellin's been pointed out.
Yeah, I know. I mean, to live in Bogota, so much going through it, but we're all lunatics.
I mean, most of the best people I know are. So I you know.
Listen, we've done a huge podcast for this week, but I think that's good for the opening podcast episode for this year. Can we remind all of you?
Please do. Yes. No, and as you've just heard, I read Semana for you guys. I subject myself to all kinds of media to make sure that I'm getting a neutral range of all of the week's most important stories. And we now have a subscribers-only Facebook group where some extra content goes in. And you'll have me on WhatsApp. So if you have questions like these, I'll be doing Q&As once a month at least. So please do sign up. But if you don't, or if you don't feel like it, Happy New Year anyway. And we'll be here on the podcast every week. You can find us here. Fingers crossed.
Listen, thank you, Emily, for your time. It's dark.
No, thank you for having me. Oh, it's so dark. Oh, gosh. It's dark. I'm going to need another cup of tea.
We'll sign off for today. This was the first episode of 2022, an exciting year here in Colombia. Of course it is. Thank you to Emily Hart for sharing more time and effort with us this week. She clearly read up for the questions and offered very insightful responses, to which I pale.
That is my job, but thank you.
And so we will sign off this week, and we'll be back next week. I have an author lined up, and then the week after that I've got a forensic investigator. So there you go.
Wow.
So we're going for it, and hopefully Emily will have interviews as well in the pipeline. So we're looking
at, yes, those are indeed in the pipeline. Thanks so much for having me, Richard, and Happy New Year.
You're all of you. Happy New Year, Emily, and let's sign off for today and be safe, everyone. I mean, despite, you know, the flu-like symptoms of Omicron, it's still a virus out there. So, all right. Thank you again, and bye-bye.